Wiping my eyes, I drifted over to kiss Raphael on top of his head. You are going to be the death of me. His ears went red.
I wasn't menacing?
But he grinned and winked. I was terrified for my life. I wiped my tears away on my sleeve before they could spin out into the room. See? I'm weeping. The Innership radio crackled.
Thanks, gang. That was swell.
It took me a moment to recognize the rasping voice as Ruby.
We all loved it.
Florence picked up the mic.
How are you all doing over there?
Oh, we're fine. Don't you worry about us.
Somewhere behind her, someone was making a retching sound.
Gotta run. Thanks, though. Means a lot that you're thinking of us.
The line went quiet. Florence sighed and restowed the mic in its usual spot.
I've never heard such a bald-faced lie. Never?
Leonard raised an eyebrow.
Not even the time I complimented that pie thing you made.
You hush! She gave him a shove that sent him spinning up to the roof of the comm module. It was a Japanese fruit pie, my mama's recipe.
Is your mama Japanese?
You hush! She looked back at the speaker as if she could see through it to the Pinta.
I don't mind saying that I'm worried about them.
Camilla says that they should be just about over the worst of it. I mean, I was worried too. But there really wasn't anything we could do. Medicating E. coli made it worse, apparently. So it had to run its course. Drumming her fingers on her console, Florence gnawed her lower lip.
It just seems as if...
The ship intercom came on and Parker drawled.
If the band of merry players are finished with their derring-do, perhaps they would deign to return to duties.
Florence picked up the mic.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm right at my station.
The rest of us floated out the door, heading up the spindle. Ahead of me, Terrazas asked Raphael.
Do you think Parker listened?
Of course.
He nudged Terrazas gently with his shoulder.
You did good.
At dinner that night, Parker walked in holding a piece of teletype paper. We were all still laughing and a little giddy from the show. Like a switch, the laughter stopped. There is a face that accompanies news of death. As astronauts, as survivors of the meteor, as veterans of World War II, all of us had seen it too often not to know what was coming. What we didn't know was who. I set down the stack of plates I was holding. The air in the room seemed to stop circulating, even though the only sound was the high whir of the fan. Parker looked down at the page.
Ruby Donaldson is dead. She had a seizure. Mission Control believes it was hemolytic uremic syndrome caused by the E. coli.
Damn it.
Camilla sat down and rested her forehead on her fists.
We should have gone over there.
There's nothing...
That is a fucking lie.
She slapped her hands on the table.
Ruby was dosing herself with anti-diarrhea meds so she could keep helping the rest of the crew. You do that and the Shiga toxins don't get flushed. Don't flush the toxins and they start causing clotting. That seizure wasn't a byproduct of E. coli. It was a byproduct of our decision. We chose this.
The silence in the room echoed with that truth. It raised a cold shiver down the length of my spine, along with memories of all the contingency scenarios where an astronaut might have to choose to let a colleague die because to try to save them would doom both people. Had that really been the case here? Would we have been so at risk if we had gone over to help? Parker broke the silence with an audible inhalation. He crossed the room and crouched in front of Camilla.
I'm sorry. And you're right.
He rested a hand on her shoulder.
It was still the correct call when Mission Control made it.
I'm going over there.
Still clutching that paper in his hand, Parker drew a long, slow breath.
I'll back you on that.
He wet his lips and looked at me.
York, you've had nursing training, right?
Just field medicine in the war, and what I picked up from my mother, which made her sound like a hedge witch or something. She was a doctor. Parker nodded and shifted his weight, looking at the floor.
Are you willing to pilot the busy bee over?
Terrazas stepped forward.
I can do that.
I know you can.
Parker looked up and pursed his lips. He sighed again, squeezing Camilla's shoulder as he stood.
But the fact of the matter is that York and I can get away with bucking Mission Control's orders in ways that none of you can. If the lady astronaut takes Shamoon on a mission of mercy, they won't ground her when we get back.
Well, there's got to be something I'm good for. I shrugged. It'll make good publicity. They'll love that.
Parker gave a twisted smile. And stay suited. I don't want any of that coming back here or infecting either of you.
18. Announcer.
The American Broadcasting Company presents Headline Edition with Taylor Grant, November 28th, 1962.
Grant.
Aboard the first Mars expedition, tragedy has struck with the death of Lieutenant Ruby Donaldson of Grand Haven, Michigan. Lieutenant Donaldson was a medic aboard the Pinta and succumbed to an infection introduced from a contaminated food supply. Flags around the world are being flown at half-staff in recognition of her sacrifice.
My breath hissed in my ears, surrounded by the hard shell of my Mars suit's helmet. This was not a full EVA suit, just a pressure suit like the one I wore on my first launch. My hands and the stiff gloves were clumsy on the controls of the busy bee. At my side, Camilla sat encased in her own suit. We occupied the same space by some definitions, and yet we did not breathe the same air. The docking hatch on the side of the Pinta stayed centered in the busy bee's viewfinder as I eased it in to dock. Even in the midst of all of this, a part of me was still thrilled that I was being allowed to dock solo. Absurd. And yet, when the nose of the busy bee bumped against the hull of the Pinta and our automatic clamps grabbed hold, I looked at Camilla as if she should be proud of me. She had already begun unbuckling her belt. I activated our between-suit comms. Let me secure the busy bee first.
Do you need me for that?
No, but...
Then I'll get going. We only have 7 hours of air.
She pushed out of her seat, floating up over the back of it. At least let me make sure that we're docked securely. My checklist still had half a dozen retro thrusters to secure.
The delta pressure gauge is at 4.9.
She had drifted back to the door. Camilla, she knew better than this. Rushing was a sure way to get killed in space. Let's go through the checklist. Slow is fast.
By all that's holy, you sound like Parker.
But she slowed down and checked the indicators and got visual confirmation through the windows. Well, he and I did start going into space in the days where the rockets were held together with aluminum foil. I switched bands to broadcast back to our ship. Nina, Busy Bee 1. We've docked, and all systems are optimal.
Make sure you get visual confirmation before you open that hatch.
Parker's command caused Camilla to look at me and smirk.
Slow is fast.
Trust him to recite that particular mantra now?
Yes, sir.
Camilla is doing that right now.
I'm glad one of you has sense.
I ground my teeth and hoped that the microphone picked it up. Once I've finished securing the busy bee, we'll board.
Don't forget that you only have 7 hours of oxygen.
Why do people like to say the obvious?
Yes, sir. We'll keep an eye on the time and our indicators.
You'll need to allow enough time to get back here and be hosed down.
I am fairly certain that my sigh was audible.
Yes, sir.
I'll remind Camilla of the time constraints. Busy Bee 1 out. By the time I had the Busy Bee secured, Camilla had unpacked her med kit and opened the port. On the other side, the Pinta's airlock awaited us, a single light shining to indicate which way was up in the metal cube. The round window in the interior door showed a glow from the spindle beyond. In the early days, the hatches could only be opened from the inside, but they changed that after a sim in which EVA walkers had died because the crew inside was incapacitated. It's funny how things can seem so obvious in hindsight. This was one of the positives about the IAC and all of their simulations. We can also gain hindsight from things that aren't actually lethal. I picked up the second med kit that Camilla had packed and floated after her into the airlock. We had to wait while the pumps circulated, verifying that the pressure in the two spaces matched before we could open the door. It didn't seem like the occasion for one of the airlock games, even if they usually made the time pass faster. What else was there to say? We'd worked the problem back on the Nina, and I knew what our game plan was. Reviewing it would just make me more like Parker, apparently. On the other hand, he wasn't wrong. I cleared my throat. Jim first?
That's where Ruby said they were bunking.
Camilla glanced over at the indicator.
I swear, this gets slower every time.
So maybe it was time for an airlock game. We could try some mime? Camilla snorted.
Did you just make a rhyme?
I don't think it's a crime.
That's a question of paradigm.
I gnawed my lower lip. Paradigm was a good one. Well, some people think that a rhyme is sublime. Inside her helmet, Camilla nodded.
And some people think it's finally.
The delta pressure gauge rose into the safe zone and she reached for the door.
About time.
That merited a laugh. Camilla anchored herself with one of the rails and pushed the door open. We floated through, medkits in tow, into the spindle of the Pinta, about a quarter of the way up from the rear of the craft. The lights shone on the long white tunnel at full brilliance. Somehow I'd expected everything to be gray and dim over here, but the electrical system worked perfectly. I looked up the length of the spindle toward the intersection where the ring supports met and gasped. A brown, lumpy, watery globe as large as my head spun slowly in an air current. Another smaller one hovered farther up the spindle. Now that I was looking for them, there were dozens of small globules littering the air. My God. They need a Hoover, not a doctor.
They need both.
Camilla pushed the medkit in front of her and floated up the spindle.
I'll head to the gym. You want to see if you can get this cleaned up?
And I thought the stopped-up toilet had been bad. Even swathed in a suit designed to protect me from the harsh environment of Mars, I still had the urge to scrub my hands with lye. In truth, I did wash the gloves of the suit after I finished cleaning up the spindle. It took over half of my allotted 5 hours, and I hadn't even gotten to the crew quarters yet. We slept in zero-G, and I was willing to bet that area was a nightmare. Ruby had been smart to move them all down to the gym, where the gravity would keep the diarrhea more contained. I slid down the ladder to the ring and clumped over to the gym module. The Mars suit wasn't as heavy as a full EVA suit, but was still ungainly. I stopped in the bathroom to wash my hands again and recoiled at the sight of a brown streak down one wall. Someone had made an attempt to clean it up, but had really just smeared it further. What I wanted to do was go back to the Niña, get all the bleach, and soak in it. Instead, I washed my gloves, then opened the supply cabinet to get out the Lysol, proud sponsor of the space program, emblazoned on the side of the bottle. It took 30 seconds, maybe a minute, to clean up that smear. Weird that the spinning globes of excrement didn't say illness as much as this imperfectly cleaned smear did. Those might have just escaped from containment through a malfunction. This was an astronaut who had known that they needed to clean and who had been too sick to finish the job. I washed my gloves again and spritzed Lysol on them for good measure. Then I headed into the gym. Camilla knelt by Benkoski, wiping his forehead with a damp cloth. I'd honestly half expected her to have taken off her suit in some sort of heroic measure of helping the sick, but she hadn't. The tableau reminded me of exactly how far we had come since the meteor struck. I know, you'd think that being in outer space would be enough, but it had become routine. In this context, the Mars suit stood out and I saw it anew, all silver mylar and white tubes and chrome and steel and plastic. We might have been something out of Flash Gordon or Buck Rogers. What can I do?
Give Tibir an IV. He won't let me touch him.
She looked at me, face framed by her helmet, and, much like seeing the Mars suit out of context, I was reminded of how brown her skin was. It was not that I had forgotten that Camilla was an Arab, but I had forgotten that Tibir could see only that aspect of her. She indicated the medkit with a toss of her head.
You know how to administer an IV?
I understand the principles, but I've never done it. I walked over to the med kit, which sat on the weight bench, and knelt next to it. He won't let you touch him?
Really?
He's delirious.
She stood and clomped over to join me.
I'm choosing to believe that.
He's slime. Of course, that's just a rhyme.
If I had a time...
She opened the kit and pulled out one of the bags of saline she'd packed.
You'll have to set him up with a subcutaneous drip, unless you feel like you can find a vein in these blasted gloves.
I've never even done it without gloves. What I find fascinating is that, while my heart rate had ticked up a notch, the idea of administering an IV was significantly less nerve-wracking than having Parker grill me about Yiddish. The brain makes absolutely no sense sometimes. My hands were steady as I took the IV from her. Can you talk me through it? She shrugged and grinned.
Since you aren't going into a vein, you can basically stab him anywhere. It hurts more if you go into the hand, because there are more nerves there, and failing to let the alcohol swab dry is definitely painful, because some of the alcohol enters the bloodstream with the needle. It produces a burning sensation, just as a point of information, as Parker says.
But despite her implied threats, she still bled the air from the line and followed me over to where DeBeer lay curled up on one of the wrestling mats. He was wrapped in a stained blanket. What skin I could see had taken on a yellowed, papery texture and cracked at his lips. When I knelt by DeBeer, his eyes opened. Red veins spiderwebbed around the blue of his irises, and mucus clung to the corners of his lids. His tongue flicked out to wet his lips.
York.
He coughed once, then closed his eyes again. I watched his chest with an intentness usually reserved for a launch to make certain he was still breathing. How is it that I can simultaneously loathe someone and also not want them to die? Taking in a breath of recycled air, I slid the blanket down to expose his arms. His eyes snapped open again and he grabbed the blanket. I nearly fumbled the needle and dropped it, or stabbed myself. His breath hissed as he said something in Afrikaans. I'm not actually sure what he said, but from the way his gaze darted to Camilla, I could make a fair guess. He wasn't delirious, just a racist asshole. What if I sit on him?
I don't want to risk him cracking your faceplate, although...
Camilla turned away from me.
Huh.
What? I shifted to follow her gaze, which was taking in the rest of the gym. With the exception of DeBeer, the rest of the crew had clean blankets and had been given at least a sponge bath. All of them had IVs going.
Well, it's just that there are all of these weights.
She picked up a pair of 10-kilogram dumbbells.
And he really is weak as a kitten. And he needs fluids.
And a bath.
Or face my wrath.
I stood laughing as I understood her intention. We could put these on the blanket and pin him down that way. I like this path. The dumbbells seemed like they might roll, so I grabbed a flat weight for the barbells. Getting a good grip with the gloves meant I could only carry one, but Camilla saw what I was doing and put the dumbbells down. She grabbed the matching weight, and like some sort of space Valkyries, we approached DeBeer from either side. His eyes were closed, and he had the blanket conveniently pulled up to his neck with both arms inside, as if he were trying to cocoon himself. I plunked my weight down next to his right shoulder, capturing the blanket underneath it. Camilla did the same thing on the other side, effectively pinning his chest. If he'd been at full strength, this would only have slowed him down, but, as it was, by the time he opened his eyes, I'd already straddled his legs and had them held down beneath my full body weight. He thrashed and grunted, then abruptly stopped with a moan. One side of the blanket had been rucked up at his waist, and a pool of watery brown discharge crept across the wrestling mat. Across the room, Heidi and Dawn leaned against each other, propped up by the wall. Dawn had her arm around Heidi, who was clapping. No one likes him. The thing about emergencies is that people don't waste energy on white lies. After the meteor, some things the refugees said were... blunt would be generous. I patted his knee. DeBeer, you have to let Camilla give you fluids.
You?
I don't know how. The best I can do is subcutaneous, and it's not as effective. He shook his head, ending with it pressed to the mat on the side away from Camilla. This was stupid. We had him pinned. So I looked up at Camilla and gave the best shrug I could in the suit. She grimaced and came down to me.
I'll go into a vein in the legs if you can hold him.
Binkowski pushed himself up on an elbow.
Oh, for fuck's sake, DeBeer. Take the goddamned IV like a man. That is a direct order.
I'm in a Mars suit, so my taint won't touch you.
Camilla scowled at the puddle on the mat.
You can let me do my job, or you can lie here in your own shit.
DeBeer kept his face pressed against the mat, but he didn't struggle. If anything, he went limp. Camilla gestured for me to get off his legs, then she slid the weights to the side. Standing, she ripped the blanket off of him.
We'll get him cleaned up first.
Hopefully there won't be another outburst. I stood and headed to the bathroom to grab the Lysol. Behind me, Camilla said,
He won't be the first asshole I've nursed.
19. Announcer.
This is the BBC World News. For Wednesday, 28th November, 1962. Reports from the first Mars expedition have raised concerns in the international community after the death of Lieutenant Ruby Donaldson. Some of the vigils following her death have been marred by Earth First protesters who claim that the stated cause of death is part of a government cover-up to hide so-called space germs. These germs, they say, are a threat to life on Earth and raise questions about what other contaminants will come back from the surface of Mars.
When we finally finished getting De Beer cleaned up and put an IV line in him, Binkowski struggled to his feet. He leaned on the chair that held his IV bag.
Hey.
Camilla sprinted to him, which I didn't know you could do in these suits.
What are you doing?
Ruby.
He shrugged and looked at the floor.
I got her in the bag.
The bag. That was one of the scenarios covered in that report on mid-mission contingencies that Nathaniel had been reading back on Earth. Contingency meaning that an astronaut dies in space. So far, none of the deaths in space have left a body to bury. The rest of them had received the astronaut's version of a Viking funeral, but without warning or even the opportunity to die first. Morbid, but sometimes we make these jokes just to survive. So what happens when an astronaut dies in the middle of a 3-year mission? You can't send the body into the Earth's atmosphere to burn up because you are millions of kilometers away. Do you store it until you reach Mars? Or get back to Earth? What does that do to the crew, knowing that their colleague's body is along for the ride? Or, being the IAC, do you create a new system that allows the remains to be returned home in a compact and sanitary way? The bag was a heavy plastic body bag that contained the astronauts' remains so they could be placed in an airlock and exposed to the vacuum of space until the body within froze solid. When an organic form has been exposed to the vacuum of space for about an hour, it fractures easily. Shake a bag containing frozen organic material and it becomes dust, even the bones and teeth. Dust can easily be compacted into a neat cube for transportation home and interment in the ceremony of choice. The bag had not been used on a human yet. I took a slow breath, wishing that my air supply had a little more oxygen in the mix. Is she in an airlock? He nodded.
The number 3 forward. I just couldn't do the rest. I tried, but I'm so goddamned weak right now.
Camilla rested a hand on his shoulder.
We'll take care of her.
I'll come with you.
He picked up his IV bag and rested it on his shoulder.
And before you tell me no, I promise not to exert myself and to come straight back here after.
Putting her hands on her hips, Camilla glared at him.
There won't be anything you can do.
I can say goodbye.
Binkowski drew himself erect. Seeing him with something that passed for military bearing made the amount of weight he'd lost during the past week painfully clear. The three of us trooped out of the gym, or rather, Camilla and I clomped out, and Binkowski trailed after us, resting one hand against the wall. I stopped and waited until he caught up. Lean on me? The corner of his mouth turned up in a wry smile.
Thanks. I feel useless.
You aren't. I tucked an arm around his waist. You got De Beer to behave. His arms settled across my shoulders, pressing the O-ring of my helmet down into the muscle at the base of my neck.
If you can call it that. I should have reined him in early, but I figured ordering him to behave would just make him dig in on the racism.
I looked up at him as best I could in my helmet. With his weight on its O-ring, all I could really see was his chin. I'm surprised that he was included in the crew.
Parker tried to get him kicked off.
Binkowski sighed and then coughed. I stopped to let him catch his breath. I didn't know that.
Clemens said no. Budget. South Africa was kicking in a huge amount of money.
Binkowski straightened and kept going.
But my job is to try to keep the ship running, and he's my co-pilot. Good times.
Does the IAC know he's still giving you trouble?
Nah. Nothing they could do, and they'd probably try counseling or some shit like that. With a time delay.
He let go of me when we reached the foot of the ladder up to the spindle.
I should be good from here.
I can always give you a push if you have trouble climbing. Binkowski laughed and patted his own rump.
Yeah, diaper's not full yet, so have at it.
Camilla looked down from above us.
I am not washing your ass again.
I can do it myself.
Binkowski started hauling himself up the ladder. I followed just in case he slipped, though what I would have done if that happened, I don't know. Wedged my suit into place in the ladder shaft? As I came out into the spindle, Binkowski had himself anchored to the wall with one hand, and Camilla was at his side looking at the IV bag.
God damn it. Sorry. I should have thought of this. I was just distracted.
Camilla shook her head.
You'll have to go back down to gravity.
What? Why?
The saline drip is gravity-fed. It's doing no good right now.
She took him by the shoulders and turned him back toward the ladder.
Sorry, but that is fact.
I'll be fine.
He looked to me for support.
Elma, tell her I'll be fine.
No. I shook my head. There are many things I will argue with, but not a doctor who is making a declaration. And don't make me get Parker on the line to give you a direct order. He opened his mouth like he was going to argue, then clapped it shut.
All right. I will be sensible and go back down.
Camilla waited until he started down the ladder before she turned toward the forward airlocks, up near crew quarters. As we floated up the length of the ship side by side, I kept looking for something to say. The weight of what we were heading toward almost provided its own gravity. Even if Binkowski hadn't told us which airlock, it would have been obvious, since the Delta pressure gauge showed a vacuum on the other side. Camilla pressed the button to close the exterior door, and once it was shut, I opened the valve to let atmosphere roar into the airlock. I could think of no rhymes or even a sentence to start the game. Camilla cleared her throat beside me.
Ruby Donaldson was a fine medic and a wicked hand at bridge. She could dance the Lindy Hop and make it look like she was in zero gravity, even on Earth. We were in the same class of astronauts, and I will never forget the first day we met. She had those pigtails that make her look like she's 12 years old. And when some guy asked if she had gotten lost from a school tour, she'd looked up at him and said, "Yeah, I'm from the fucking School of Hard Knocks, and I'm here to teach you not to make assumptions. I'll miss her."
I hadn't needed to cry up until right that moment. The tears threatened to form pools in front of my eyes, and I blinked hard and fast to clear them. Ruby Donaldson was a dedicated astronaut and a compassionate doctor. She took every part of her job seriously, even when it wasn't glamorous. I never heard her complain about long hours, and she even offered to stay later if a teammate needed help. The first time I met Ruby, she was on the moon to learn how to drive a rover. I will never forget her yelling, "Yeehaw!" I wanted to buy her a lasso. The hiss of my breath filled the world around me as I stared through my helmet at the indicator. We waited for another 2 minutes before the pressure rose high enough to open the hatch. I looked through the window into the dimly lit cube to confirm that the outer hatch really was shut. A translucent plastic bag floated in the middle with thick handles on both ends. It had settled against Ruby's neck, so you could just make out her shoulder and the side of her head. Swallowing, I undogged the hatch and pulled the door open, bracing against one of the guide rails. Camilla followed me into the airlock. She rested a hand on the body and squeezed.
Solid.
I glanced at my oxygen indicator. I think I was hoping that it would be too low to stay here and that we'd have to leave, but the gauge showed that I had plenty of air to do this and still get back to the Niña. Setting my jaw, I grabbed one of the handles and wrapped my other hand around one of the guide rails. In my mind, I began reciting the mourner's Kaddish. Yit gadal v'yit kadash shemei rabah be'alma divra. On three? Camilla nodded, taking the other handle.
One, two, three.
Chirutei v'yamlich malchutei b'chayechon. The bag lofted toward the ceiling as easily as if we were shaking out a sheet. At the top of the arc, we snapped it back down. For a moment, the plastic outlined Ruby's face and chest and even her pigtails. Then she began to shatter. At the bottom of the swing, the bag shook with three distinct thumps. Uvyo mechon, uvchae, dechol beit Israel, ba'agala. Up, the bag trembled as myriad rigid, sharp angles struck it. Uvizman kariv, vimru, amin. Down. The bag shuddered in my grip with the fall of dozens of rocks. Yehe shmei rabba mevarach le'alam ul almei almeya. Up. Something round pressed against the bag like a child's head devoid of features. Yitbarach v'yishtvach v'yitpa'ar v'yitrumam. Down. The airlock had full atmosphere rather than the blessed silence of vacuum. The pebbles in the bag drummed and rattled. V'yit nase, v'yit hadar, v'yit ala, v'yit halal. Up and down, and up and down, and god damn it. After we finished, after we got back to the busy bee, after I had to take my helmet off because I couldn't see to fly, even after we got back to the Nina, I could still feel Ruby's body shattering through the lingering vibration in my hands. The only thing for which I could be grateful was that Binkowski hadn't been able to come with us.
20. Disaster effects found to persist. Report on meteor survivors given by psychiatrists. By Emma Harrison. Special to the National Times. Toronto, Canada, November 29th, 1962. 10 years after the meteor slammed into the Chesapeake Bay, wiping out Washington, D.C. and much of the eastern seaboard, the meteor's survivors showed marked psychological deterioration, two psychiatrists said yesterday. The survivors also reported a variety of physical complaints that physicians believed were psychologically induced. Psychiatrists have tended to believe that a victim's previous personality is a major factor in the degree of mental disturbance after the accident, but Dr. Robert L. Leopold and Dr. Harold Dillon posited that the similar reactions of a large group of men over a long period opened a pre-accident personality theory to question. The two psychiatrists first examined the men right after the disaster and found typical post-accident behavior. Many were bewildered, anxious, and could not sleep, and had digestive disturbances. A few seemed overwhelmed. Upon re-examination, most of the survivors were found to be more disturbed than they had been 10 years earlier. They had developed many new complaints, feelings of isolation, of being watched, and hostility and distrust toward others.
I needed Nathaniel. Ruby's, whatever the hell that was, had left me with nightmares. I had not needed to ask Camilla for Milltown. She offered it as soon as we got back. Of course she'd read my file. Of course it would be on the ship for when I needed it. But I didn't want it to be so obvious that I needed one. I didn't want to need one. And I don't know what Camilla took herself. We did not talk about Ruby, although in my incident report I said that the bag should never, ever be used for a person. But I needed Nathaniel. So I took myself up to the comm module along with a binder covering the various burns we would need to do on the journey. The transmission delay was long enough now that I would need something to keep me occupied while I waited. Plus, it would cover me working out the code from Nathaniel's response. Florence looked up from a novel when I swung into the module. Need anything? I was hoping the teletype was free. It sat idle, bolted to its spot on the side of the comm module. Got a message from Nathaniel to answer. She waved a hand toward the machine.
Be my guest. But I hope you don't mind if I ignore you. Valentine Michael Smith just laughed.
She buried her nose back in her book. That was fine by me because it would reduce the likelihood that she'd notice me writing garbage. Today's word for the keyed Caesar was on page 30, line 7, word 4. Rhinoceros. So the alphabet was RHINOCESABDFGJKLMPQTUVWXYZ. In code, I wrote, "We had to use the bag thing to break up Ruby's body. Please tell me that you were not in the meetings that approved that horrible thing. I can't get it out of my head. What the hell was Clemens thinking to commission that? And who tested it that couldn't immediately see the problems? No one should ever, ever have to use it. I wound up taking a Milltown to get to sleep. In the clear. Dear Nathaniel, I'm not sure what they're saying on Earth about Ruby's death, but I'll tell you that she was working right up until the end. I wish we'd gone over sooner, but I understand why Mission Control made the decision they did. Hindsight is always 20/20 and all that. Still, I can't help but wonder if we could have saved her. Everyone on the Pinta is doing much better, but I guess you know that since they're back in communication. Binkowski says they're all still reeling a little, but everyone feels better to be working. Speaking of working, I was glad to hear that Tommy came out for fall break. I think that's a good way for him to start getting used to life in Kansas City before he starts his internship. Thank you for taking him bowling and introducing him to the folks from Adler. He's been talking about wanting to be an astronomer for ages now. I think this will be a great opportunity for him. Please take pictures so I can see them when I get home. All my love, Elma." And then I added in code, "When I said that I understood why Mission Control made the decision they did, I lied. I don't. I mean, I did at the time, but as soon as we headed over in the Mars suits, it just seemed so obvious that we could have done that sooner. All conversation about going over was shut down before we even had a chance to work the problem. Honestly, I think it's criminal that Ruby's dead." I could have kept going, but I sat back and waited for him to respond. Or rather, I waited for the signals from the teletype to travel millions of kilometers to Earth. In 5 minutes, someone would get the message and give it to Nathaniel. He would be at the office now, so unless he was in a meeting, he'd come to the machine right away. Especially since I had mentioned Milltown. He was going to tell me to be careful and ask if I'd talked to anyone about how upsetting dealing with the bag had been. As if there were anyone I could talk with on the ship. The only person who made sense was Camilla, and she had gone through the very same thing. I couldn't exactly complain to her. I grabbed my binder and flipped it open to the first page. Launch. That wasn't a page we needed anymore. I popped the binder open and pulled the launch pages out, tucking them between my legs to keep them from floating away. Had anyone asked an actual astronaut about the bag? I would ask Nathaniel when he responded, because if they had, then I wanted to talk to the SOB who said that it would work. And if they hadn't, that was a whole nother angry conversation. The next pages in my binder covered Earth orbit and transition out of orbit. Those could go too. The force of pulling them out caused me to drift a little toward Florence, so I put a hand on the ceiling to stop myself. Pushing gently, I eased back over toward the teletype machine. Nathaniel should have my message by now, unless he was in a meeting. He might be in a meeting. I used to know his schedule down to the second. Now all I knew for certain was that he was at work, and even that might not be true. He might be out of town. No, he would have told me that he had a trip planned. Wouldn't he? Besides, he wouldn't go anywhere with Tommy in town for the week. I gnawed on the inside of my lip and turned back to my binder. Trans-Mars injection burn. Those I still needed. In another 6 months, we'd be crossing out of Earth's sphere of gravitational influence and into the bare edges of Mars's pull. I closed the metal rings of the binder and flipped to the back so I could insert my loose pages there. Granted, I didn't need them anymore, but the IAC always wanted them back, complete with my handwritten notes all over them, for posterity. The teletype rattled to life next to me. Florence flinched at the sudden noise, spinning upward before she grabbed the desk to steady herself. "Lord! That thing gives me a fright every single time." "I know what you mean." I wedged my binder between the teletype and the wall. As the paper scrolled over the carriage, it began to lift up toward the ceiling like a paper beanstalk.
Nearly half a page of random characters went past before I saw 37-4, which meant that everything after that would be Nathaniel using the same keyword. Now the machine began to slow because it was responding to human touch. In films, they sometimes show teletypes as these fast, automated things, but that's not what they are, not even at this distance. They instantly transmit the typist's touch, so each stroke, each pause, each hesitation as you think of what to say next are sent to your correspondent. I put my hand on the side of the machine, which hummed under my touch. As Nathaniel typed, I relished those tiny impacts against the carriage as echoes of his fingers against mine. There was a long pause in the code, long enough that part of me was wondering if the transmission had been interrupted. The rest of me could imagine Nathaniel leaning over the keyboard with his lower lip caught between his teeth and a line drawn between his brows. The code translated as,
"I'm sorry you're having such a rough time of it. I read your formal report, and it sounded like the bag functioned as intended. I need some help understanding what didn't work about it. Have you needed to take any other Milltown after that first night?"
That is where he paused.
"You know I worry about you, but I'm glad you tell me things like this."
In the clear, he wrote,
"My dearest Elma, you and the rest of the crew have my sincere condolences. Everyone here is gutted about Ruby, particularly her colleagues in the flight surgeon's department, who feel like it is a personal failing of theirs. And of course, they all knew Ruby better than I did and speak of her in the highest possible terms. It has been a blessing having Tommy here this week. His presence has been a good distraction and is encouraging me to eat meals on a regular basis. I wonder if I consumed the sheer amount of food that he seems to need at each meal when I was his age. Actually, I know I did, because I remember our housekeeper complaining about it. She said she couldn't keep a gallon of milk in the house, and I know now how she felt. On the plus side, our refrigerator is spotlessly clean. He's a good worker. I'm looking forward to having him here for the summer, although I might move into one of the one-bedroom apartments just for a little privacy. You wouldn't mind having more room when you come back, would you? We can always move again if you don't like it. As always, I adore you. Nathaniel."
And in code again,
"It occurs to me that you might talk to Camilla about whatever is troubling you. I know that Parker is not a source of comfort, but Camilla at least ought to be, through her medical background. I just worry about you letting the anxiety overwhelm you again."
There is a substantial difference between being upset about having to pulverize a colleague and anxiety. I put my fingers on the keyboard to tell him so, then jerked them away again. I couldn't write that in plain text. I'd have to put it into our code first. I took a slow breath and rearranged the letters of the alphabet in my mind. To be on the safe side, I wrote it out on the back of the old launch worksheet, driving my pencil into the paper so hard that it left an indentation. Then I propped it open and let it float next to the teletype as I copied out the coded text. "Nathaniel, this is not anxiety. I am not anxious about anything. I am, however, viscerally disturbed by the process of pulverizing Ruby Donaldson. You asked what didn't work about it? The bag functions as designed and allows the pulverization of anything freeze-dried, but during the process, it is possible to see recognizable pieces of the deceased striking the bag. You can also feel each strike through the handles." Belatedly, I realized that I couldn't just send the coded message, or it would look like garbage going through without anything attached to it. What had we been talking about in the clear, as it were? Oh, a new apartment. "Dear Nathaniel, I think you should make yourself as comfortable as you can while I'm gone. It's a little ironic that you need more space without me than with me, but it makes sense to want a place to retreat from Tommy. Besides, then you won't have to deal with the Murphy bed every day, which will be nice, I think. I know I don't miss putting it up and down. It'll be another 2.5 years before I can see the place. All I ask is that there is at least a view of some trees. I find that the garden module is one of my favorite spots on the ship. I think the aroma of earth and vegetation gives me comfort. I loved our tiny little Central Park on the moon for much the same reason.
You don't realize how amazing the color green is until you live without it for so long. Love, Elma. And in code. Regarding the bag, please imagine if it were me and you saw my face pressed against the interior of the bag. Please imagine feeling pieces of my body hitting the bag and the strikes vibrating through the strap in your hands, even with gloves on. Please imagine feeling those pieces get smaller and smaller until you felt only the hissing of sand against the inside and you knew that it had once been me. I took my hands off the keyboard and floated back, fingers still vibrating from the machine, as if I had shaken Ruby's remains all over again.
You going to keep fighting with him?
Florence had looked up from her book with her head cocked to the side. Why do you think we're fighting? I plucked my notebook out of the air and shut it.
As hard as you were hitting those keys?
She snorted and closed her book.
What'd he do?
Weren't you reading? Florence wedged her book into a small net bag on the wall next to the radio. She crossed her arms, lips pursed.
If you stop fighting, maybe I will, but the racket you were making? Uh-uh.
What's wrong? If I hadn't been trying so hard to build some sort of rapport with Florence, I might have continued to dodge this question. As it was, I felt like I needed to respond to any interest in my personal life. I sighed and spun in the air to face her fully. The bags. I want the IAC to scrap them and come up with a different plan. She shuddered.
Yeah. Camilla told me about that. Jesus.
A bitter volt of jealousy coursed through my body. But why? What right did I have to be jealous that Camilla confided in Florence? They'd worked together longer than with me and had a right to friendship outside of work, but... It's funny. What can snap something into focus for you? I had colleagues on the ship, but I had not become friends with anyone. Camilla and Florence spent leisure time together. So did Rafael and Terrazas, Parker and Terrazas, Leonard and Florence, Camilla and Rafael. There were pair bonds and friendships stretching throughout the crew, but I didn't have any of my own. Not truly. I'm not sure if it was because they still resented me for taking Helen's place, or because I was married to the lead engineer, or just because... I swallowed the bitterness. Nathaniel thinks it sounds like the bag worked within expected parameters and doesn't see what the problem is.
Why are men such idiots?
It boggles the mind. It really does. I rattled the page he'd sent. And Nathaniel is one of the good ones. I mean, he cooks, he's hosting my nephew, he's amazing in all other ways. It's only when he gets his engineer hat on that he sometimes can't see past the design parameters to the people. The bag functioned as intended. Ugh.
Well, you tell him where he can store that bag. And if I pass, you can just jettison me. I'd rather spend eternity floating in space than as a bunch of sand.
Not that I'd be aware either way, but the thought made me shudder. Same, though. I scanned the module looking for something wood and settled for knocking on the paper in my binder. Let's hope there's no need to worry about that for anyone.
Oh, I don't know. There's some folks.
She shrugged, cocking her head to the side.
I'd be tempted to just shove him out an airlock at the first opportunity.
Maybe I should just accidentally lose our store of the bag.
Yeah, be a damn shame if anything happened to those.
She grinned slowly.
Cam and Terrazas would help.
That would be a pleasant letter to type and send home. Dear Nathaniel, I'm ever so sorry, but we somehow accidentally jettisoned all the bags on both ships. I don't know how we managed to get rid of such a barbaric piece of equipment. I do hope... The teletype rattled to life. Both of us jumped at the abrupt noise and then laughed.
Every single time.
Florence had a hand on her chest, still laughing.
Every time.
The laughter helped propel me over to the machine. As the actual garbage rolled into the garbage, I leaned over the machine, decrypting in my head.
I'm sorry. You are absolutely right that none of us thought about the effect on the crew. I am so sorry. May I please ask you to send a follow-up report with the details so that I can share it in the next meeting? We will find another solution, although I hope to God there will never be a need for it.
I had been so prepared to have to fight to get him to understand that I was left with a ball of anger that had no target. It was mingled with relief and gratitude that I was lucky enough to be married to a man who understood. and also shame, because I should have known he would understand. Nathaniel was the best of men.
Dear Elma, I will absolutely look for an apartment with a view of trees, and thank you for reminding me that I take the greenery on Earth for granted. I think we all do, when surrounded by so much life all the time. It is hard to remember what an exception our planet is in the solar system without a reminder of how fragile life is. You have all my love, Nathaniel.
And then there was a single string of garbage.
Every day I think of you and all the ways in which you might die in space. Please don't.
This time I didn't wait, and I didn't bother encoding anything, because my response to both parts was the same. Thank you. I love you. I pushed back from the teletype to find Florence looking at me over her book. She cocked her head to the side.
And?
He just apologized and asked me to do an update to my report with details about the effect on the crew. I folded the pages he'd sent, running my fingers over the crease as if it were the back of his hand. He'll present it in the next meeting.
Huh.
Shaking her head, Florence opened her novel again.
Wonders never cease. A man with some sense.
And it would be 2 years, 5 months, 3 weeks, and 4 days before I saw him again. Not that I was counting. 21.
Cygnus 6 trial continues by Robert Alden. Special to the National Times. Kansas City, Kansas, December 14th, 1962. The trial of 6 men accused of hijacking an International Aerospace Coalition rocket last year continued today. The United States government asked that the trial be moved to Kansas City due to security concerns. 32 armed guards, including 6 soldiers armed with submachine guns, crowded into the small courtroom. Heavy cordons of United Nations troops ringed the courthouse, and persons entering were searched before they were admitted. The man accused of being the leader of the group is a handsome 34-year-old Negro insurance agent. He is considered by the police a key man in the plot and a key man in many terrorist activities.
In a corner of the observation dome, which, despite the name, is not actually a dome, Rafael played his guitar. The facets of the dodecahedron shaped the sound and bounced it around us. Aside from Parker and Camilla, we had all gravitated toward the dome for our off-duty time. I was drifting near the apex with a copy of The Gods of Mars from the ship library. For reasons that remain unclear to me, we did not have the first book in the series, but the Pinta did. Sometimes the decisions that Mission Control made were opaque. Fortunately, you didn't really need to have read A Princess of Mars to follow what was going on in the sequel. It was harder, however, to ignore the weird popping sound that Tarazas kept making with his lips. Somehow, I hadn't noticed it on our trip to the moon, but dear God, it was constant when he was thinking. I glanced over the edge of my book, where he floated with a clipboard, making notes, no doubt, on his next radio script. You aren't even eating anything.
What?
He lifted his head. That noise is just... Could you stop, please?
What noise?
Tarazas scratched his nose with his pencil. Rafael saved me by popping his lips like a slow-motion fart.
Love ya, but it's obnoxious.
Tarazas laughed, shaking his head.
I do not. Do I? Oh, hell, Elma...
Leonard snapped his mouth shut so hard his teeth clacked audibly. He held the newspaper so tightly that the teletype pages crinkled beneath his fists. I lowered my book. What's wrong?
Nothing.
He gave a smile that I didn't believe for a second and straightened the sheet. The movement set him drifting in a loose circle. Florence glanced over from the needlepoint she was working on.
The article about the march or the one about the trial? It's nothing. I just remembered that I needed to ask Elma to help me in the lab, but it can wait.
Well, that was obviously bullshit. I shut my book, and Rafael stopped playing the guitar. Pushing off, I floated a little closer to Leonard. What trial?
For the Cygnus 6. Old news.
He grimaced and turned the page.
Hey, Florence. Looks like you've got a fan on Earth. Gene Roddenberry is saying you inspired a character in his new TV show.
What are you leaving out? I tucked my book into one of the pockets on my flight suit. Leonard leaned his head back to stare at the stars. Florence stopped with her needle poised over the fabric.
May as well tell her, you know she's not one to leave well enough alone.
He sighed and lowered his head, turning back to the page that evidently held the story about the trial.
Among the questions raised was the possible involvement of IAC employees in the crash of the Cygnus 14 rocket. While the so-called Lady Astronaut has been acclaimed as a heroine for her efforts, recent investigations by this paper have uncovered that she has a history of mental illness.
A wave of cold revulsion swept through me. I wanted to have misheard him. But I knew Earth well enough to know that I'd heard him with perfect, dreadful clarity. I did what I always do when I'm trying to mask my anxiety. I made a joke. Given our choice of careers, they could say that about all of us.
So it's true.
Florence stabbed the cloth with a vengeance.
Hey.
Tarazis let go of his clipboard and set it spinning in front of him. That's... I swallowed and crossed my arms across my torso. God, I wanted to lie to them, and I'm so proud of myself that I didn't. I had problems with anxiety.
Had?
Florence snorted. She wasn't wrong, but I still bristled. It's not a problem.
And Mission Control knew, didn't they?
Well, I mean, I'm married to the lead engineer, although I'd hidden the worst of it from Nathaniel for years. So, yes, Parker and Camilla knew, too. Florence stared at me, then bent her head back to her sewing. Other than that, the only reply was the whirring of the fans. I cleared my throat. Well, I had to stop saying that, but my southern roots were strong sometimes. The good thing is that it's pulling attention away from Leonard.
Who should never have been under scrutiny in the first place.
Florence's needle darted in and out of the cloth, silver catching the light with each stab.
Must be nice, not having to be perfect all the time.
That shocked a laugh or a sob out of me. You have to be kidding. What do you think the anxiety was about? I'm Jewish, and I'm a woman in science? There's never a moment where I don't get to be perfect.
Taking Milltown is a mark of perfection.
How did you... I closed my eyes as if that would hide me from scrutiny. It's in the paper.
Florence.
Leonard's voice was low and urgent.
No, she just got to waltz in and take the spot of someone else. You think there's no link?
1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13. I didn't have to worry about what people would think. I knew. My breath came in shallow pants, and I forced my lungs to shudder into a longer breath as I opened my eyes. Oh, for God's sake! What the hell do I have to do to prove to you that I'm pulling my weight? Florence whipped around in the air to face me, thread trailing behind her in an arc.
You still don't get it. Was I angry that Helen was bumped? Yes, but ask yourself why Mission Control chose to bump the Taiwanese computer and not the white computer.
I opened my mouth to retort, but had nothing. So I just floated there, mouth gaping. I know. But there were reasons beyond the fact that Helen wasn't white. Publicity wanted Parker and me on the same ship.
Sure, let's go with that theory.
Florence gave a single nod. Look, if it were just that, they would have pulled Leonard at the first hint of trouble.
Trouble?
Florence glanced over at Leonard.
You hear her? I do.
Maybe I was just trying to get attention away from me, I don't know. You know it's true. I mean, De Beer did his darndest to make that happen.
And why not you, hmm?
Leonard folded the newspaper into quarters, then folded it again and again, driving his thumbnail along the edge of the paper.
Why was I part of the conspiracy and not you?
I knew the answer, of course. He was black. Okay. I see your point. My hands were sweating. I jammed them farther into my armpits. But the fact is that you still got to come on the mission. You're here, right? So neither of us has to be perfect.
But your imperfection is in your brain.
Leonard held up his hand.
Mine is here.
I'm not. 21, 34, 55, 89. This wasn't about me. Florence had just told me that. That is not an imperfection.
You are a brilliant astronaut and damn well deserve to be on this mission. And what do they have us doing here?
Florence tilted her head.
Scrubbing walls, cleaning toilets, cooking, laundry.
Well, we all do that. I did a toilet repair 2 weeks out and...
Stop talking, Elma. Leonard crumpled the teletype paper. For the love of God, stop talking!
My heart rate began to achieve escape velocity, and sweat clung to the back of my neck in warm droplets. Leonard had never so much as raised his voice.
I am trying to remember that you mean well. But at the moment, I cannot take the protestations of a well-meaning white woman. I do not have the energy to reassure you, or to pretend I am happy and content with my lot in life.
I'm sorry. I dug my fingers into my sides. I'm sorry, I was only trying to help.
Help?
Florence folded up her sewing.
You can help by shutting up instead of being openly clueless.
Terraza snorted.
You're acting like she's De Beer. In case you haven't noticed, cleaning the ship is part of all of our jobs. Not you too. Pay attention to the duty roster next Monday. Tell me that it isn't uneven.
She shoved her sewing into a bag that had been floating tethered to her waist.
Now, if you'll excuse me, I should check the laundry.
She was being ridiculous. There were only 7 of us on the ship, so it wasn't like there was a staff that came in to tidy up after us. But we all clean. That's part of basic maintenance.
Yes.
Leonard slapped the folded newspaper against his palm.
Yes, we all clean. But the rest of you are assigned to do other tasks relating to the maintenance of the ship. Florence and I aren't.
Raphael said,
It's true. Leonard was trained to assist me in engineering. But Mission Control's roster keeps giving me Estevan, who only shadowed him.
Terrazas turned his head, brows raised.
I thought you liked having me help.
I do.
Red flushed Raphael's ears.
But you're missing the point. It should be Leonard.
Thank you.
Leonard scowled down at the pages. I turned to Raphael and Terrazas, although I'm not sure exactly what I wanted. Reassurance that I wasn't a terrible person? Confirmation that I was? The lines of Raphael's face looked as dragged out as if he'd spent the day in the neutral buoyancy lab. Compressing his lips, he turned back to Terrazas and smiled. Sort of. His lips curved up at any rate.
What was that song you wanted me to learn?
Breathing hurt. I bit down on the inside of my cheek. Rotating, I pushed off and flew through the door into the spindle. And because I'm a professional, I actually made it to the gravity toilet in the centrifugal ring before I threw up. From the toilet, I made my way up the spindle to the comm module. I figured that chances of Parker or Camilla being there were slim, and I was rewarded by finding the module empty and dark. Chewing on the inside of my lip, I hung in the doorway for a minute. The teletype sat there, a link to Nathaniel. I wanted to tell him everything, and also didn't want to worry him. But I'd promised I would be honest with him. And being 97 million kilometers away didn't change that vow. I pushed through the door and floated to the machine, rotating to a good working position. Stretching out, I hooked my feet under one of the guide rails to anchor myself as I wrote. I didn't have Kipling's book with me, so I picked a word we'd already used. Rhinoceros. And then in code I told him, I just threw up. It's the first time on this mission. I suppose you've seen the article about the Cygnus 6 that talks about my anxiety problem. Leonard brought it up. I thought all of this was behind me and was blindsided. Then somehow the conversation just degenerated into anger all around. I'm fine now. I know you won't believe me, but the fact that I'm telling you that I was upset ought to reassure you. At least a little. I hope it won't happen again. God, it's been so long since I threw up like that. I can't believe that it used to be regular. But really, I'm fine. I'm only telling you because I promised I would. Dear Nathaniel, the news from Earth seems fairly bleak sometimes. I feel awful for those who were hit by the typhoons in the Indian Ocean. I have to remind myself that our mission exists to provide some hope for those trapped in untenable situations on Earth. As the weather worsens, we hope to establish a new beachhead for humanity in the stars. I've been reading The Gods of Mars and am quite enjoying the absurdity of it. The first book in the series is on the Pinta, so I've asked Camilla to pick it up the next time she goes over on a medical visit. Everyone's health continues to be good, thank heavens. How goes the apartment search? All my love, Elma. And then in code. Everyone's physical health is good, as is mine. but tempers are stretched to the breaking point. There are times that I wish we weren't getting news from home beyond letters from family and friends. Please do keep those coming. I miss you terribly. It was late in Kansas and a weekend. As much as I wanted to hear from Nathaniel, I hoped that he wasn't still at work. Though knowing my husband, he very well might be. On second thought, he should be at his poker game tonight. I sighed, trying to release some of the ache in my chest, and went to find Leonard. I found Leonard in the garden module. He sat on the bench in the middle of the hydroponic rows of tomatoes. I guess the original design hadn't included seating, but it didn't take long to understand how much humans craved the sight of greenery in space. As I walked in, I scuffed my feet against the metal grates in the floor to catch his attention. Leonard looked up, hands knit together, and sighed.
Elma, I'm sorry I yelled at you.
That stopped me in my tracks. You don't... I was coming to apologize to you. I was wrong. He snorted.
My mother once told me that an apology wasn't about being right or wrong, but showing that the relationship was more important than the problem, and you aren't actually the problem.
I contributed, though, and I was wrong, and you're important to me.
I appreciate that.
He stretched his hands out, flexing the fingers wide.
But I was explaining why I apologized to you.
Oh. I stood on one foot, feeling like my dad was disappointed in me. The leaves of the tomato plants stirred in the breeze from the fans and spread their earthy scent in the air. With a finger, I reached out and traced the veins on a leaf. Do you... Back on Lunetta, you and Florence asked me not to get involved, but if you want, I can nudge Nathaniel to nudge someone else about the duty rosters, but only if you want. Leonard shook his head, standing with a groan.
Thank you. I appreciate the offer and the spirit in which it was made, but no. I think Raphael might request me now, and that will do more good than anything else. Probably should have talked to him sooner.
Is there anything I can do? Leonard shrugged.
No, thank you.
He started to walk out of the module, but stopped at the end of the row, framed by the verdant plants. Turning, he held up a finger.
One thing. Don't explain my experience to me. It's annoying as hell.
I winced, because that's exactly what I had done, multiple times. Everything from explaining that we all cleaned, to telling him that he wasn't being singled out. And I knew how annoying it was, because Parker did it to me all the time. Copy. No explanations.
Roger.
He winked.
See you at dinner.
After Leonard left, I settled on the bench he had vacated. It was only after I had relaxed into the green that I realized that I had effectively chased him out of the module. 22.
Advertising magazine show an upturn in business by Peter Bart. December 27th, 1962. Magazine advertising salesmen who have been wearing baleful expressions for months now are